seven, six, five, four, three.
It has been said about Mrs. Shirley Williams here in England that she's perhaps the only, quotes, left-wing politician who is intelligent, idealistic, and sensible at the same time. The operative word being, I take it, sensible, a quality which one had thought was discouraged in members of the Socialist Party. Mrs. Williams is not only a member of the Labour Party, but a very important member of it. Indeed, she is the shadow Home Secretary, which means that if the Labour Party were to come to power tomorrow, she would occupy the second most important post in the party. Indeed, she has been spoken about quite even handedly, not to say resignedly, as not unlikely the first woman Prime Minister of England. Mrs. Williams is the daughter of a novelist who was staunchly feminist and of a father who, as professor of political scientist, was an early critic of Adolf Hitler. But during the World War, Shirley Williams was sent to America briefly to school, and on returning to England and studying at Oxford, she then went back to America to study the trade union movement at Columbia University. She began then to run for office, failing three times before she was elected to the House. Meanwhile, she served as secretary for the Fabian Society, and since becoming an MP, has served in various of the social ministries until reaching her current eminence as Shadow Home Secretary. She is married to a professor of philosophy at Oxford and has a daughter, Rebecca. Mrs. Williams is very deeply committed to socialism and in a recent interview declared herself to be at the service of a mission she understands to be Christian in its provenance and direction. I should like to begin by asking Mrs. Williams about the term democratic socialism. On which of the two terms does the Christian place primary emphasis?
If you don't mind me being a bit sort of offside for a minute, not playing the game completely, may I quarrel with the original description? Because if I may say so, it's a good conservative description of any left-winger. I don't see any reason why left-wingers shouldn't be idealistic, sensible, and intelligent, and most of my colleagues seem to me to be all three. So you don't mind me just quarrelling with that to start with.
Not in the least.
Democratic socialism, well, it's, if you like, it's socialism by the hardest road. One accepts that. It's the idea, really, that you can persuade people in the end that the profit motive is not the highest motive by which people should work and live, that it's possible, perhaps, to get across some concept of service, of sharing, which is where perhaps one might say the Christian bit comes in, some sense of the community, and that societies like ours, which are very complicated and very technologically interdependent, perhaps now need to look again at what we sometimes regard as the instincts of politics, and should not therefore be as self-interested as we have believed in the past that politics was able to be. And so when we talk about social democracy, we talk about the socialism in the sense of greater equality, not just of opportunity, but equality regardless of opportunity, equality for those who can never make the most of their opportunities. And we argue that this can be achieved by the democratic method. And can I say very quickly, of course, accepting the democratic method accepts delays, accepts slowness, accepts the method of persuasion. But it may be that if one can make changes and reforms in this way, they will be more lasting than a revolution, which so often destroys itself by creating a new ruling group with total power, which then becomes self-destructive.
Yes.
I'm sorry about that long speech.
No. Write it. I think I should have made my question a little bit more pointed. Your commitment to socialism is a very considerable commitment. So is your commitment to democracy. What I'm asking you is this: as a Christian, if you have to forsake one or the other, which of the two do you forsake?
I think the answer to that what politicians tend to say, if I don't answer hypothetical questions, I will answer
it. Why not?
Well, I would forsake socialism for democracy.
I see.
Because well, I
that,
think
well,
that...
Well,
oh, really, because what I really want to, what's the central to my philosophy, I suppose, is a dispersal, a sharing of power. I can't believe in a straight free enterprise society because it concentrates power in the hands of a small number of people who achieve that power through business, through industry, and so on. We'll disagree about that later.
So the quintessential concentration of power is in the government. There'll be only one government, but there'll be lots of...
No, I'd say not necessarily so. But I think that what we've got is, if you like, Galbraith's argument about countervailing powers. That's to say, you get concentrations of power in industry, in financial hands and so on. And basically what the government has to do is to enter into a dialogue in which it's by no means always the most powerful. And I would have thought the history of the United States and Britain since the war demonstrated that the government was by no means always the most powerful. But I don't equally want a government which is so powerful, like that of the Soviet Union, that in effect it can order the way in which people live. So I may want something that you will argue is impossible of achievement, that's to say the maximum individual liberty, but in a situation where power is distributed as widely as can be.
Well, I think this is probably fair to say about everybody in this room, that what would be absolutely ideal is if everybody voluntarily did what we want them to do. And therefore we could call it democratic or socialism or democratic whatever. But it seems to me that in your use of the term, you seem to get in the way of some of your philosophical axioms. Let me give you an example. You recently asked, suppose you were Home Secretary and somebody declined to accept medication, that person being a Jehovah's Witness or a Christian Scientist. Your answer was, quote, "Well, for so long as I'm an agent of the state, I would assert the right of the state, which is that person should be treated, over against my respect for that person's individual right to..."
Do you mind if I in a minute?
Sure.
Because it's very crucial what the question was. The question was not about a person, it was about their child.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if a person decides that they don't want medication, an adult, sure, that's their business. If they want to commit suicide, they want to commit suicide. I wasn't answering that question. I would have thought I had no right to step in on such a person's decision if they were in a full mental health. I talked about a child. Now, if the child of a Jehovah's Witness or the child of a Christian Scientist can almost certainly be saved by an operation or, in the case of a Jehovah's Witness, a transfusion of blood, then it seems to me that one has a role as guardian of that child as well as the parent. And it was in that situation I was talking about insisting that it took place, not in the situation of an adult,
okay,
which I think is very different.
It is different, and I'm glad for the clarification. But as I understand it, then you are saying that that the state denies to the parent sovereignty over a child beyond the exercise of certain powers, among them whether that child should submit to medication, even if it is against the religion of the parent, right?
Yeah, if you don't mind me saying so, I think this is true of all states. I mean, I know of no state in the modern world, or only in a developed state, where the state doesn't occasionally step in, for example, in the case of a battered baby, or in the case of a child which is totally out of the control of its parents, in your country and in mine, the state then steps in and gets a care and protection order, or in the case of the United States, it may decide that the boy shall be sent to a probation home. But in all cases, there is a final stage at which the state, whatever its philosophy, does step in vis-a-vis the parents if they think the parents are unable to care for the child.
In fact, in America, it is a moot point,
mm-hmm,
because it has never been asserted as an unambiguous constitutional doctrine that one can reach over the mother or the father, except in clear cases of mutilation or cruelty or whatever. But here is what I want very much to hear your views on. One talks, as you do, about socialism as being really the Christian way of doing things. And I guess I need to ask you, assuming that we agree that this is so, what is it that inhibits you from desiring the institution of socialism, if it simply happens adventitiously, if 51% of the people are opposed to it? If 51% of people are in favor of it, then you will gladly go and become Home Secretary and socialize everything, right? And therefore, never mind the 49%.
Well, you know what I'm saying, that...
What is it that's so critical about
democracy? It's dichotomism, that, isn't it? If you live in a democratic society, you impose upon yourself certain limits, even if you have so-called power.
Why?
You impose upon yourself certain... Why? Because that is part of your concept, that there are certain things you do not...
What your concept?
No, wait a minute, can I finish the sentence?
Sure.
Look, there are some things that when...
But you were correcting me, though. You said, when you live in such a society, you, meaning us all,
yes,
right?
Us all, us all.
But I said, no, not necessarily. From
America,
we have a Bill of Rights, and the Bill of Rights, a Bill of Rights is supposed to survive the animadversions of the majority, or even the supermajority.
We don't have a Bill of Rights, but we have, in a sense, a very strong concept of what is constitutionally possible. And I think in this country, as in the States, it's fair to say that there are some things the government would not regard it as being within its power to do because we're a citizen.
But that's not absolute, isn't it?
Pardon? But why can't I say that one of the features of a democracy, in the full sense of the word, is that indeed it has a certain quality of self-absolute
among
its citizens? Of course it does.
Doesn't it?
Of course it does.
Well, if you are arriving in your office, freshly endowed with political power, a desire to... take away my business and nationalize it, you apparently feel absolutely no reluctance to do this.
Ah, but I feel I have to pay you for it. I compensate you for it.
I don't want your money. I want my business.
Sure, you want your business. And I can equally say, I mean, this works both ways, doesn't it? I can equally say that in the United States, the state has done nothing about the evident desire of at least substantial groups in the community to have a full medical service. But it isn't done. Why? Because you've got interest groups that are against it. So what I'm really trying to say...
You mean by interest groups all the doctors and nurses who are opposed to it?
Yes, I do. Mm.
Well, but in point of fact, since we have flirted with socialist medicine, their incomes have gone up. But some of them are still...
We've flirted with it in a very distant way.
Well, we've doubled the federal expenditures on medicine in the last 3 years. The interesting thing about it is we have no more hospital bed, no more doctors, no more nurses. We just have priceless expensive medicine.
But we embrace socialized medicine, as you would call it.
Yeah.
Our doctors and nurses' incomes have gone up too. But the difference is that we spend less
of
our...
Mind.
Oh, come. The great part of the moment. And the crucial factor is that the proportion of gross national product spent on health is less in Britain than it is in the States. And yet, I think it's very hard to argue against the assertion I will now make, which is that the medical treatment of the great bulk of the population is almost certainly better in Britain than it is in the States.
Yeah,
I will now bear this out by one statistic, which is that our life expectation and our infant mortality in a poorer country are both more favourable than yours.
Well, as you know, those figures have been questioned. We are terribly diligent statistics gatherers.
Sure.
And under the circumstances, it may very well be that we record more dead people than you do.
Oh, dead. I'm not talking about Northern Ireland now.
In any case, we're talking about a percentile. As you know, Iceland is way ahead of you, and nobody quite knows why, because Iceland doesn't have socialized medicine.
They have more socialized medicine than you do, though.
Yeah.
Every European state does, virtually.
Well, if you're saying that you want to construct a theology on the proposition that people die in inverse ratio to the extent of socialism.
I might almost do that. I'm prepared to try.
Okay, fine. But now, here's what I'm really interested in pursuing, and what you said is completely relevant. Why, if one envisions the desirable situation in any society as a socialist situation, why shouldn't we cavil at its being undemocratic? The notion that 51% of the people should dominate 49% of the people is really a Western superstition. It's one that you and I are attached to, but purely for reasons of tradition. It's utterly laughable, as you know, among most of the societies of this world. The notion that you go and decide the future of a country on the basis of which paper ballot box is teeming at the end of a day's exercise is simply funny. But what is not funny is the substantive point that you as a socialist make. Namely, that people ought not to be permitted to do their own thing, to go and accumulate, to engage in the professions they want, for whatever reasons they want. What I don't understand is why we cavil at democracy.
Well, now I have to start a little way back with that statement, because I think I disagree with almost every bit of it. Look, first of all, I do want to stress the point that when I talk about democracy, I'm talking about something which is essentially what you put, as you put it earlier, it is a self-imposed constraint on your own power.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I understand by democracy, and it doesn't much matter whether we're talking about right or left-wing democracy, the constraint is the same. And if a right-wing party, as it were, attacks that by making, for instance, the life of a particular minority intolerable, then that, it seems to me, party is going beyond what anyone can accept as democracy. This is where...
Anyone?
No, let me take the precise example. Hitler was elected in Germany.
Right.
We do not call him a Democrat. We don't call him a Democrat because although he was elected by a majority of the German people in 1933, his treatment of certain minorities in Germany were bound to make us say that he was going beyond those admittedly extremely difficult to define restraints, and neither your country nor mine would feel it was a democracy if you stood up your black minority or we stood up our Irish
minority. I am willing to say something you're not willing to say.
Part of a democracy?
No.
Part of a democracy is understanding the rights of minorities.
It's part of the kind of democracy you and I approve of, but it's not part of democracy.
I think it certainly is. I mean, we're using the phrase democracy. It can be defined in many, many ways and has been defined in many, many ways. If you define it in terms of, let's say, some pure mathematical model, what you say about a majority is right. But if I define it in the terms in which, say, Locke defined it, to take a person who had great influence on the American Constitution...
Locke was not a Democrat.
Locke was certainly a man who...
Absolutely not.
With great respect, he defined one essential part of democracy, which is what one means by the rule of consent and the social contract. And what I'm really trying to argue is that unless you're just cavilling for the sake of it, sensitive definition of democracy, one has a concept that minorities, the people who disagree with you, have certain rights you do not destroy. Now, if we can accept that for a moment, and maybe you want to disagree with it later, but I don't think in any democracy that you and I would so define, we would agree that the majority by itself has the right to do anything. Now, in a socialist country...
Let's agree that that's true, but let's also agree that this is something concerning which there is by no means a universal agreement. Hitler considered himself a Democrat, the Soviet Union calls itself a democracy.
All right, sure.
So does the Hanoi government, so does the Chinese Republic.
Well, that Spain does too, for all I know.
Okay, but there are some pretty fancy justifications of this. Which trace back also to important Western figures like Rousseau and the Hobbes.
Sure, but I mean, if you and I are going to talk in, if I may say so, the common language of Western society, when we use the term democracy, we do not define Spain as a democracy. We do not define Portugal as a democracy. We don't define the Soviet Union in our sense as democracy. So I'm simply trying to define democracy as I thought most Americans and most English people and most Western Europeans would use the term. And it seems to me that this constraint of government, this refusal to take all power unto itself, is part of what one means by democracy. And this is quite crucial for social democracy because it means you go ahead with reforms for which you have massive support, as we do for the National Health Service. It means you can go ahead with reforms which you have substantial support, as for example I think one would now for a large increase in old age pensions. It means you're in real difficulty. You've got to persuade people about reforms like comprehensive schooling, but I think most people are now persuaded. It's been an uphill struggle. And it's significant the government did not impose this, the Labour government, until basically there was a consensus in which most people accepted
it,
at least the majority of public
sector. Ms. Williams, I'm not trying to argue with you, but I want you to elaborate something which continues to be very inscrutable to me. In a democracy, one assumes that legislation that is passed is acquiesced in by the majority, right? So that if you say, let's have more support for old people, what you're saying is let's tax non-old people more than we have been taxing them, and give the proceeds to old people. Now, if you assume, as you would in a model situation of democracy, that there is acquiescence in this new old age world, then really people voting for auto-taxation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, that which distinguishes the non-old people from taking money out of their own pocket and passing it along to a particular fund is the coercive character of it. I.e., the reason it has to go through Parliament is in order to isolate and move in on that minority that does not acquiesce in this measure. Now, I'm asking you to give me consistently a definition of democracy that authorizes the majority to act in such a way towards the minority when their financial or other support is not necessary for the consummation of the measure in question.
Well, I can't imagine many where it isn't, in the sense that what we're talking about is community provision for a state in which everyone will pass through. In other words, there really is a distinction between provision for sickness or provision for old age, which is the common loss of humanity, than there is for provision for a particular, let's say, additional privilege for a particular group. In other words, I think that there is, well, let me give you an example. When people here ask the question, what reform would you most like to see? The answer which came out in a recent poll was an increase in old age pensions. And when people were asked what they would most like to see a government do, one of the answers to that which came very near the top, in both cases a majority of those asked, was a reduction in taxation.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the problems of politics, isn't it? That people often want totally incompatible things.
A dilemma.
Now, it seems to me that what very often a government does, what often the choice that you're faced with between governments, is that the public want two things which are inconsistent, and one party, legitimately enough, says, a majority of you want X, higher pensions, and the other party says, no, a majority of you want X, lower taxes. And if you can't have both, then it seems to me perfectly reasonable for a party to take one view or the other, because the public says it wants both.
But the difference between you and me, and the difference between me and the Soviet Union, is that my respect for the minority inhibits me from accosting it when it is not necessary to do so. I can understand that if England has to go to war, England has to go to war, and you can't tell all the people in England, don't want to go to war, they can't go to war. That I understand, that it's only a corporate decision. But most of socialism is not necessarily a corporate decision, and yet you make it so. And you make it so, I think, because you tend subtly to understress the democratic character of your faith and to overstress the socialist character of your faith. And of course, in doing so, you really address yourself rather punitively to the recalcitrant minority.
But now, why does a costing minority necessarily always have to take a positive form? We know, for example, in the States in the last couple of months, that a very substantial majority of those affected by it, that's to say people with incomes of $3,000 a year and less, want the Great Society programs to continue. Now, your government, under President Nixon, is using the majority to accost the minority and say no, end of Great Society programs.
But don't you think that's how
No.
What Mr. Nixon is saying to the majority is, I have come belatedly to the recognition that the money that has been taken from you to finance an unproductive program really is yours. You can hardly say that you are victimizing the minority if you permit the majority to keep money that was theirs in the first instance, can you?
Yes, you can, in a sense, because what you're doing in the States, it seems to me, I don't want to make this general, what we're all doing in a way.
That's right, you've been doing a part of it for years, you've worked
for it. We're even stealing on that one. Essentially what you do is to create a situation, which all our societies create, where you begin to have a minority which is locked into a fairly hopeless situation in a city core which is decaying and so forth and so on. Now, really the difference between us is that we would say, I think, I'm now talking as a social democrat, that part of the responsibility of a society is at least to make life readily tolerable for its least well-off citizens, if you like, its least educated citizens. In other words, that they must share in it, that this is part of the concept of the democracy, that people should share in what it has to offer.
Yeah, but what if
now,
they choose not to?
You can't do that without losing some of the money that's made by the richest people.
Why not? Let me give you an example.
Because we have no resources.
Let me give you an example. We have an American institution called the Red Cross, which is terribly successful. But you can go through your whole life in the United States without contributing one penny to the Red Cross. You are no less eligible for its services if it happens that you should suffer. They don't ask you how you ever contributed. They simply give it to you. Now, what's wrong with that? To begin with, what's wrong with that? Should the Red Cross be nationalized in order to fit in your paradigm?
If you don't, I mean, we have an organization called the Red Cross, too. It doesn't exactly supply welfare for everybody.
I didn't say welfare for everybody.
Oh, sorry.
I said treatment.
Well, it doesn't supply treatment for everybody, really, does it?
I don't know about yours.
Sure, it does. But I'm not talking about an immediate incident. I'm talking about a permanent earthquake. In other words, where you're always the victim and the casualty, where you simply are the victim and casualty of society.
Why can't you have permanent Red Cross?
Well, all right, you've got to finance it somehow. No Red Cross is financed on the basis
can't you finance
of the
kind that you want. Because under democratic socialism, I repeat, you're really voting for auto taxation. If it's really democratic, then the majority of the people are saying, we want the money to go from our pockets to that end. So all we're really talking about is the deadbeats, if you like, the people who don't want to participate. And I'm asking you why you want to organize whole societies around that punitive expedition.
But with respect, I'm really less honest about that. I really am, because look,
in the States,
you've been taxing people compulsorily for years.
I know.
In order to pay for a war, which at certain stages...
Which is a corporate activity, isn't it?
Well, it's corporate activity, but at certain stages, the majority of both the Congress and Gallup poll have shown people don't want that war.
No, I grant that some functions in the nature of things cannot permit.
But what's the great distinction between compulsory taxation for a war that nobody wants and compulsory taxation for a health service everybody wants,
The distinction is as follows, and it's a metaphysical distinction. Is it possible for a state to undertake certain kinds of activity without conscripting the whole of the society to that purpose? I gave you an example of the Red Cross. I don't think the Battle of Britain could have been fought on a sort of a high purchase basis. And under the circumstances, I grant that it needed to be a collective decision involving comprehending the whole of England. If you can show me how wars could be fought otherwise, I would say, let's make them otherwise. In fact, the tendency in America, you may have noticed, is now to go to a volunteer army. And I applaud this, so do some left-wingers. But I applaud it precisely because, it seems to me, a virtual society is one in which you do not unnecessarily conscript the cooperation of minority, of people who dissent.
Well, let me take your metaphysical distinction, because you've got too many angels dancing on top of your pin. Of course you're right in a situation in which the survival of a country is threatened.
Yeah.
Right. I think one, if I may use a theological term, most of us would describe that as a just war in theological terms. And if a country's survival is threatened, as ours was during the Battle of Britain, as you could say that yours was during the Civil War, sure, you've made your point. But nobody suggests that Vietnam threatened the survival of the United States.
Oh, some did, yes. Theoretically.
Well, it's very hard to argue.
Happened in East
Africa at the time of the uprisings in Tanzania and Kenya threatened the survival of the United States.
I was aboard at the time, but very responsible American say if we didn't come to help England, the United States would be threatened.
Sure.
Building up to Hitler gets this and Latin America and so forth. But they weren't preposterous, the people who said that.
No, but there you see, the crucial point I'm making is that whether you look at your society or at mine, or at the most right-wing society you care to name, societies in fact use taxation for the collective financing of things with which a majority may not agree.
Because the emphasis is not on democracy, it's on socialism.
Yes, but in all democratic and undemocratic societies, taxation is used in these ways. Now, you and I are both saying that the hallmark of democracy is that, in effect, the leader or the party goes to the people and says, we want to use your taxation for the following purposes.
And respects the minority, that's what you said.
Yes, and respects the minority, right. Okay. But I mean, the other party then says, we want to use your taxation for the following opposite purposes, or maybe we don't want to use it at all. Now, in either case, in any case, in a modern state, there's going to be an argument about the use of taxation. But you're opposing a more fundamental argument.
Not
you're
so
saying
well.
Taxation is by its nature wrong. Now, I do not see how you can sustain this argument
I'm saying, in any
situation which there's any collectivity.
The theoretical structure of democracy, as you were invited to define it, and did most enthusiastically and eloquently, is one that proceeds with some reference to the right of minorities.
Sure.
I'm saying, therefore, if you indeed respect the right of the minorities, where is it that you find the divine warrant for conscripting the cooperation of minority when it is not necessary to do so, simply because you have become infatuated with a socialist vision?
The crucial question, of course, that you put in there is when it is not necessary to do so.
Let's look at whether it's not necessary to do so. It wasn't necessary,
in a sense, to have a national health service in this country. It wasn't necessary to have a national health service in this country.
Correct.
It was, however, what clearly at that time a great many people wanted.
No, they wanted Hitler too, a few years earlier.
No, but wait, hang on, you can't make that parallel.
No, I'm just saying the fact that a lot of people wanted it, in the terms of our discussion, does not...
But let me, I wasn't, this isn't the main point. The main point I was trying to get at was you've got to isolate what were the elements in the way in which we did it which made it done in a democratic way. And the answers are two answers which the AMA doesn't believe to be the case, but they're quite wrong. The first is that a patient can choose his doctor, and the second is that a doctor can, if he wishes, leave the country or leave the National Health Service. Now, these seem to be a doctor, and the second is that a doctor can, if he wishes, leave the country or leave the National Health Service. Now, these seem to me to be elements of choice which make it a democratic sort of health service.
Yeah, but if I may say so, at the moment that you pass that bill, no doctor could leave the country and take any capital with him. He could leave with $50.
That isn't strictly true.
It is true.
It isn't true. We had a trial.
After years, you couldn't leave England.
Everybody was in the same boat.
You're perfectly free to go, only you've got to leave everything in this country that you built up over the years.
That's absolutely accurate. But it isn't accurate. £50 is a travel allowance for going on holiday. If you migrated to another country...
This minute, no. But it was accurate.
No, it wasn't even accurate.
It didn't have to do with the bill, but at the time the bill was passed, that was the law in England.
You should be ashamed of yourself. Look, the law in England about the right to remove capital had been the same ever since the war. It was nothing special to the doctors. It had nothing to do with the National Health Service. It had to do with the national crisis. And as the financial situation improved, incidentally, it was never a total ban at all. It was simply an arrangement under which you could take it out bit by bit, for obvious reasons that, to go back to your collectivity, the survival of the country depended upon not having a total outrush of all the sterling held here. But it wasn't specific to doctors. It had nothing to do with the National Health Service.
Let me correct the impression. At the time that national health was promulgated in this country, no doctor could leave this country with his capital. I'm glad that you find this shocking.
No doctor could leave immediately.
The friend of this on his program a couple of years ago said, well, why the hell should he? After all, this country is...
Doctors were in the same position as everybody else. What is incorrect in your statement is A, that they could not ever get their capital out. They could, but actually. And B... The health service bill, also absolutely untrue. And in fact, the proof of the pudding is that in the first couple of years after the NHS, and I concede you this, quite a few hundred doctors did leave the country and set up in the States and Canada and so on. It's interesting that quite a few have come back in recent years.
That's right, because we've been socializing at the other end of the...
But may I ask you just one question?
Of course.
Do you accept that the AMA was wrong when it said that you could not choose your doctor on the National Health Service?
I consider that certain, quote, choices are in fact phony. As somebody said, the rich man and the poor man are equally denied the right to sleep under a bridge. We know, in fact, that it is a highly discriminatory privilege in England to patronize one's own doctor, because most people can't afford it. Anybody who wants to can hire his own doctor, and he can leave and go to New York or Missouri or whatever, is a little bit provocative.
The
realistic thing is that most people don't have that kind of economic mobility.
But the point is that you can choose an NHS doctor, I agree, within limits. You can obviously choose a private doctor if you're on the NHS. But in the States, my impression is, if we're talking about choice, that in some cases you can't choose to have treatment at all because you can't afford it. This seems to me to be a much more large-scale invasion of individual liberties than saying you can only choose between Mr. Brown and Mr. Smith.
I suppose they taught you that when we were working with Adlai Stevenson, but in point of fact...
No, it taught me that, but I was once arguing against the AMA in the States for a long time, and a more illusory campaign I've never seen.
I would be glad publicly to reward anybody who sees this program who can document a case of somebody in America going for medical attention being turned down. In point of fact, it simply isn't a problem. There's lots that's wrong with America, but an awful lot of doctors, an awful lot of clinics work overtime to keep that kind of thing from happening. However, to rewrap the argument, would you agree that it would be ideal to go ahead and have your national health insurance, but to permit people to opt out of it to the extent they choose to do so?
We do.
Oh, no, you don't.
Must be able to
Well, you have to pay the tax.
Oh, sure.
That's oh, well, what do you mean, oh, sure?
Hmm?
Oh, sure. What do you mean, oh, sure?
Well, in fact,
this is a critical exclusion.
Yes, yeah. Sure, but I mean, I think here that it's like saying, and the analogy is exact, if I'm a conscientious objector, and you had some, I refuse to pay taxes which go to the Defence Department. Well, it would be nice, I agree with you. But in fact, it would be difficult to administer a state in that way. And I would have thought it's perfectly legitimate to say to people, if you want private medical service, you can't opt out of helping the rest of us to pay for those who can't afford it. But if you wish to have it yourself, go ahead and have it. In other words, essential to my whole argument is that the better-off person has a responsibility towards the less well-off person. And that this is
essential to the argument is that you administer that responsibility. Essential to my argument is that both of us, subscribing as we do to Catholic and Christian imperatives, believe that people should share what they have with other people. But I believe, unlike you, that you shouldn't covet your neighbor's goods.
Oh dear. Well, let us go a bit further back. There's also, I think, a fundamental theological doctrine which says that wealth is an obligation and not a privilege. I seem to remember that in Leo the 13th, Stilel Novarum, it made it very clear that those who were in charge of industry, who were employers and who were in powerful positions, financially and otherwise, had a direct responsibility for the welfare of their workpeople. This is actually spelled out to some extent in that encyclical. And it was spelled out even more strongly rather later in
Progressio Populo.
No, I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking of the earlier one by Pius the 12th. But the crucial thing here is that it seems to me that what I'm really suggesting is that the community takes on board this sense of Christian obligation, and I think this is quite widespread, a widespread philosophy among many Christians. In other words, we're members one of another. And that this can have an expression which is social and not an expression which is purely individual.
Yes, but you are attempting to reify an ethical injunction into a tissue of legislative instruments, the effect of which is to impose your ethical system on other people. And I say, A, you have no right to do it. B, you have no divine warrant to do it. And C, your concern is not really with democracy to the extent that you do it when you could exclude those who want to be excluded.
And I say you're trying to unreify a theological objection by pretending that a society which takes no notice of that theological objection is in some sense a Christian society.
You know,
I think it can be.
Look, in the first place, Rome of Rome was extraordinarily naive. It says, for instance, that if you run a factory, you have a lot of profits, you should share the profits with the people in the factory. I think that's dead wrong. What you should do is lower the price, because then you are sharing the profits with people at large rather than discriminating simply in favor of the people who work in your own immediate situation. But in any case, the notion that one can take a paper encyclical or one from Lambeth or wherever and write it into a policy.
Well, it's
to beg the difference between a personal injunction and a statement.
Well, I'm suggesting that, of course. But, I mean, if we can get back, as it were, onto the political and social argument, I think the crucial element in that political and social argument is whether you think a society has a responsibility towards its less privileged citizens or whether you think it hasn't. Now, if it has such a responsibility, then it seems to me that one has to reflect that in the policies that the state follows, and it is essential in a democracy that you persuade most other people that they believe this. Now, clearly people who opt for, in Britain, let's say, programs which involve the setting up of a welfare state, and the same is true of Germany and other countries, have chosen, if you like, that the state shall administer their willingness to help less privileged people than themselves. And I can't find any objection to that in democratic theory. It seems to me to be a form that consent can take. You're saying, if there's one bloke in that society who says, to hell with it, I don't want my taxes spent on poor people, that somehow the whole great thing should come to a stop. And that seems to me to be extraordinarily unreasonable.
Well, several observations, beginning with your last point. I didn't say that the individual should have a veto power on the collective project. But the individual ought to be permitted to absent himself in the event that he desires to absent himself, and in the event that his doing so doesn't cripple the system. I give an example. In America, we have a thing called Social Security.
Yep.
Now, it is is a documentable fact that people who begin contributing to Social Security at a certain age, by and large, do less well than they would under private pension schemes. But it is nevertheless compulsory. Now, I don't understand why one isn't permitted, as a 22-year-old girl or 22-year-old man, to say to the government, thank you very much. I don't choose to participate in your Social Security program. I'm going to deal with my local annuity guy and work through him, and he pays taxes and so on and so forth. But there is something, there is a consuming desire that, if I may say so, is distinctively socialist, to make everybody conform. And the reason for it, I think, is that you are ethically impatient of anyone who actually does not acknowledge your superior insight.
Now, why, to use a phrase of one of my socialist colleagues, you know, why look into the crystal if you can read the book? Mm. This is what Maya Bevan once said. Because, of course, there's no complicated reason of that kind at all. It's nothing to do with the fact that we try to get everybody to conform. Also, of course, universal social security systems are common in countries which have never been socialist. It's quite simply because the private insurance company will pick out the good actuarial risk, will pick out the man with a first-rate health record, will pick out, indeed, as you rightly say, the 22-year-old girl. She's got a very low actuarial risk. But it won't take on the epileptic, it won't take on the disabled, it won't take on the older person.
Well, then,
and this is invariably true with private occupational pension schemes, that they reject those who are going to be actuarially, from their point of view, less profitable.
Absolutely.
Now, society cannot reject them.
Absolutely, no doubt about it.
So who's going to pay?
If somebody is in an advanced stage of cancer and approaches somebody for life insurance policy, the first thing they say is take an insurance, or take a medical test.
That's right.
But my analysis of the situation does not foreclose on the governments having what we call in America assigned risks. Here's an example. In the state of New York, in order to drive a car, you've got to have an insurance policy.
Right.
If you've had 8 or 10 accidents in the last year, and you try to get an insurance policy, nobody will insure you. So then what they do is they require all insurance companies to take a certain percentage of these so-called assigned risks.
Yep.
Now, doesn't this please you, as distinguished from socializing the insurance companies?
Well, again, it doesn't please me very much, but I don't think with respect that the analogy holds, because nobody chooses to have cancer. But there's a sense in which a man can drive in a way that is risky. He's got more control over that. You and I have got no control over whether we get cancer tomorrow. Now, all I'm trying to say is that the logical consequence of what you're saying is that people will pull out if they can get a better deal from the private insurance company. The people who can get a better deal are those who are young, healthy, in good jobs and so on.
Why people ask them to be young and healthy?
Because the insurance company will always charge a lower... Well, let me just finish.
Why is it our business?
But look, the net effect is, and this is why it's our business, if you'll let me make this point, because it's crucial to the argument, is that if you have a state insurance scheme which is left with those who are actuarially at risk, who are the ill, the tubercular, the epileptic, and so on, the cost to you and me, who for some extraordinary reason of being, frightfully high-minded, stay in the state insurance system as healthy people, is going to be colossal. Nobody's going to stay in it who can possibly get out in that circumstance. So in the end, you're not going to be able to finance the insurance of those who most badly need it.
By definition, you finance it. Because
you've never got to be opt out who can get a better deal from the private company. You're stuck with those who've got to have insurance, who are the poor, the disabled, the wretched, the unhealthy. Who's going to pay for them? They can't pay for themselves. They've got epilepsy.
If what you're saying is that you end up isolating those people who need the charitable attentions of society, I say, for heaven's sakes, yes, let's look after them. But what's wrong with isolating them? What is the point in institutionalizing a social security system that requires Nelson Rockefeller to be a member of it? This is one of those chimerical ventures that socialism
just adores. Because Nelson Rockefeller can afford to do it. And we require that Nelson Rockefeller shall take his share in looking after an epileptic black in the slums of New York. And it seems to me absolutely right that he should.
Well, that's...
That's almost the essence of what I'm trying to say to you.
It doesn't take very much economic archaeology to know that Nelson Rockefeller is paying his share. But the only point I'm trying to make is that the socialist mentality refuses time and time again to indulge the presumption of individual, of the right of the individual to dissent.
We don't fully accept the right of the individual to be as selfish as he might be. Yes, that's I accept that. If you say that what we mean by that is that we're going to push individuals in doing things which...
But it doesn't follow as selfish, Ms. Williams. It doesn't follow at all that the person who does not desire to subscribe to the national health insurance mightn't be the most incontinent philanthropist of the century. So it has nothing to do with selfishness. It has to do with the fact that the government is here to do necessary things, not, God damn it, to conscript us all, to move martinets.
If the government is here in order to, I mean, you used the phrase, to my mind, it was a terrible phrase. What is wrong with isolating, you said, the epileptic, the unhealthy, the poor, the underprivileged? Everything is wrong with it. Because they are part of society.
I don't mean sending them to Arizona.
But isolating them, putting them in a kind of mystical ghetto, as it were.
Sure, no. Finding out who they are and looking after them.
But who's going to look after them? The Red Cross. Well, the Red Cross does a marvelous job, but what they ought to be doing is looking after people who are suffering from earthquakes in Chile.
10 times as much money was spent in America by private philanthropy as by the New Deal during the equivalent period. So I don't know what your problems are, but in America, is easily stimulated.
I find it almost impossible to believe. And I wonder whether some of that
$154 billion during the 30s.
I bet some of it went for...
Schools, sure.
I was going to say libraries and art galleries.
No question about it. You're not against those, are
you? Yeah, of course I'm not against. That's what private philanthropy ought to do with our money, in my opinion.
Yes, it should be the world of private philanthropy and its rather fantasy-like figures to a somewhat more realistic world. The key problem which Mrs. Williams identified earlier on was a choice between the amount of people who want to have higher old-age pensions and those who are reluctant to see taxes increased. And surely this is a problem a society like ours and the Americans is moving into, where the number of our affluent are increasing, and in a sense the minority who are receiving the benefits is decreasing, and it's persuading the majority.
Why is it?
Well, because of increasing affluence. The numbers of those who are necessarily poor...
Well, people getting older, aren't they, on account of longevity?
That's another problem, undoubtedly, that there's a greater number are getting old, but it's persuading those who are at work, those who are the income earners, to pay for the others, to pay for the old, to pay for
Put them in prison if they don't agree.
No, but this is a problem of persuasion.
We put more people in prison than we do every year.
Yeah, sure. This is a problem of persuasion. You would say, no, you should give up the task of persuasion, Bill. You say, no, forget it, the state shouldn't intervene at all. No, what we'd say is it should try and persuade. You can only go so far as people consent.
Yeah.
And we see this a practical example of family allowances, which is, strange enough, when they were increased in about 4 or 5 years ago, it was a very unpopular measure. Because the actual cash went to the wife. And the way that the government paid for it was increasing the taxes on the husband. And you've got this problem of persuasion. And you take
the redistribution, isn't it?
And it's one that's being threatened at the moment, by the present government, because they wish to change the system so that the family allowance is paid back as a tax credit to the husband.
And goes to the husband.
And this is something that has to be defended.
How does a woman vice president rely on this?
All the way to receiving family allowances through the mother, because it's the only way of assuring that they get
the child gets the benefit, essentially. Let me put it in a single phrase. Over the last 4 or 5 years, there is some evidence that the housekeeping that men give their wives has increased less than incomes as a whole have increased. So consequently, it just is true that wives have, as it were, lost somewhat proportionately. And if you take the family allowance away and give it to the husband, the chances of being spent on the children are rather less, because the husband is less involved in the welfare of the kids than the wife is.
Has this now become a national problem?
No, the government has raised this as a possibility, and as Helen Middleweek says, there's actually a great deal of fear all going on about it, and my own guess is that the government, if it's got any sense at all, will back away from this one. But anyway, that's a rather passing local issue.
Sorry.
Bill, this individual and this state we've been talking about are fearfully theological, and your examples are a little doubtful too, because everybody in England believes in helping old age people. Even the Conservative government does so, and does in fact do rather more than the last Labour government, of which Mrs. Williams is a member. But no, what Mrs. Williams is really about is that it's all very well saying that she believes in helping this group or that group, certainly. But what it really comes down to is that it's a demand for social power in political terms by one section of the community rather than another. And this is really what democratic socialism at the end of the day means. It means the Labour Party, a certain section of the community in England, influencing decisions and rigging, if you like, the social order in the interests of that section of the community rather than in the interests of free enterprise entrepreneurs like yourself and their equivalents in this country.
Can I just slow you down for 1 minute? You said that what the Labour Party was about was acquiring social power for one section of the community. Wouldn't that be, I mean, either that's a fair definition of any party.
Yes, indeed, I accept that.
Okay, I mean, it's a definition of democracy, not of the Labour Party.
There's a vital extra dimension which has so far been ignored.
Yeah.
And the difference is this. You say that you are always acting for the social good to help this poor minority group or whatever. But isn't it also fair to say that in your party's programme, for instance, have been levelling taxation arrangements, taxation on people who, by their enterprise, achieve high incomes, which is crippling to the nation, and you admit this.
No, I don't admit it.
No, you do it, for what I would describe as socially discriminatory reasons, which can be characterised as greed, if you like. Mm. You know, you can go to the country and your party does.
So it's done for
down the rich. Well, there aren't any.
So, we believe in greater equality. I've never denied that. Of course we do.
But that's a demand of power, isn't it? Is it a moral basis?
Well, can I answer one question at a time? You see, you said this is crippling to the country. I see no evidence that that's true at all. If you take a country like Sweden, where taxes are higher as a proportion of gross national product than they are in Britain, where they are more progressive, or as progressive as they are here, you do not see a crippling effect. I don't believe for a moment that this has a crippling effect on the economy.
Sweden is a most peculiar economy
the opposite one, then. The United States grows almost as slowly as we do. But they have a highly different sort of tax system. Countries which have tax systems somewhere between the two, like Germany and France, grow very fast. What I'm really trying to say is I don't think that for one moment the progressiveness or regressiveness of the tax system is the essential thing you look at when you try to explain economic growth. I don't think there's any proof for this at all.
Well, I'm considering the moral point that what you're simply saying is that you're going to use political power to support one section of the community and you're going to down another section of the community.
No,
it's not necessarily a moral decision. It's simply want power, we want power.
Well,
Why cloak it with sanctimony and moral righteousness?
Because I don't think either your party or mine would accept that definition. And the reason they wouldn't accept that definition is because both of them have very substantial votes, and particularly yours does, from sections of the community other than the one in which you say they're interested.
You said there was no proof of this at all. In fact, there is.
There is.
Yeah. Professor, what was the name of the journal that Keynes was editor of?
Economic Channel.
Yeah, and after that, Harrod. He published, Colin Clark published in the Economic Journal around 1945-1946 a paper in which he traced the annual growth rate and as a correlation of the percentage of the GNP absorbed by the social sector and found an absolute correlation.
Between what and what?
Well, the higher you tax, the less you grow.
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, with great respect, Colin Clark's a highly controversial economist. He's quite often wrong. And if you look at the growth rates of Britain for the last century, they've been consistently below the growth rates of, for example, Germany. This was true at the time that Bismarck had an advanced welfare state in Germany, and we had no welfare state at all.
But it didn't soak up much of the GNP.
Oh, but with respect, what I'm trying to say is
he said 25-30% was a magical figure. If you go beyond that, you constipate the economy.
Well, bad luck, because Germany has about 35%, and they seem to grow pretty fast.
Yeah.
And so does every other country in Western Europe. But I defer to my colleague who's an economist, but my impression is that the average tax rate, plus insurance, is well over 30%.
They go very fast for a number of very interesting reasons, and you probably know them. But one of them, of course, is that they spend very little towards national defense.
Oh, I accept all that,
but we're
sticking on the one point that Colin Clark made, which is that if you go over the magical figure of 25-30%, your country comes to a sort of terrible stop. It doesn't. There isn't no evidence for that.
He just said it gets sluggish.
Well, there's no evidence for that either.
But there is.
Sorry? Germany's had
the objection was to establish the mechanism for why necessarily high taxes would produce low growth.
That's
no one's quite established this. But, that does a manager who's getting 10,000 a year, and out of the extra 1,000 he might earn, some of the state takes away. Does that mean you work less hard? There's no evidence for that at all. There have actually studies have been carried out on this, both here and in the States, and it's totally inconclusive. Whether this affects it at all.
If you take two models, which is of an American society in which you've got a large amount of industry still in small private firms as well as mega corporations, where you've got individuals who are highly economically motivated, if you take that as an extreme model and pose it against a sluggish, declining British socialist state, there I think you do have a very meaningful contrast.
You're a socialist state! You're a socialist state!
That is the model to which you wish this society to move, as opposed to the one of success in America.
Are you saying that you cannot have growth at the same time as you can have redistribution, and at the same time as you can sustain a high level of national expenditure on social provision? That is utter nonsense to contend that it's true. Other nations have shown that it's possible, and growth is dependent on other factors than whether or not we tax the rich and whether we tax them progressively.
This is partly true. It's not as proven as you would make it. And the point I really am making against Mrs. Williams is that simply she's wanting to create a certain sort of society, and she's doing it not exclusively for moral reasons. She's doing it because she represents the vested interests of a certain section of
that
community. It's not a
That sense, I've got a vested interest. Of course, I'm not trying to present myself as kind of walking on a moral white sheet. I think we start out well, possibly, because Mr. Buckley perhaps takes a rather more extreme view than most of us would here. But I'm simply trying to argue that in politics there are choices. But these choices are often choices which cannot all be made. They all have the acceptance of the majority. And that what one has to do, and I don't condemn anybody or praise anybody, is to put those choices before people, and then one has an obligation to carry them out.
Subject, surely, to the limitations you began by...
Subject to not pushing the minority around it horribly.
Therefore, the whole of political discussion has to do with the rights of minorities.
Oh no, not at all. Absolutely not.
Because if you acknowledge the rights of minorities without enumerating them, it becomes the possibilities of a total flirtation with Orwellian distortion are there. Unless you say this is what you don't do to a minority.
That's right.
It becomes pure rhetoric.
Sure. And there are certain things we all understand about that. You don't stop them speaking freely. You don't take away the right to a fair trial. You don't decide to confiscate their property without compensating them. These are the kinds of basic rules of politics that we all work by in our different countries, and it doesn't really matter whether we have a Labour government or a Conservative government. This is what is understood by democracy.
Well, what do you call it when you announce that you are nationalising their profession?
That's, if I say, a very odd way of putting it. What we said to doctors was, here is the National Health Service, you may work within it, you don't have to work within it. The great bulk of them chose to work within it. Their profession was not, in that sense, nationalised. There was a nationalised alternative.
You see, Bill, if you have a system where you have a government elected to carry out a programme to administer wages to the elderly, right? They've chosen not to do it through the Red Cross. 51% of the nation said they want to do it through the government. The government works out what this will cost. It works out what it will cost per capita in taxation. Are you then saying that the proportion of people who wouldn't voluntarily have given their money to the Red Cross should be allowed the right not voluntarily to give their money to the government?
Where possible, I say precisely that, yes.
But you're saying that the money needed should not be got equitably or on some objective basis of ability to pay, or unwillingness to pay.
Unfortunately, the time is up, but I do want to... You're right, Mrs. Williams, right to define equity, but I simply beg leave for a personal exemption from your definitions, even if I'm prepared to grant you...
Maybe a personal exemption on Devil's Island or something like that.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Williams, ladies and gentlemen, on this panel.
printed bound copy of this program, send 25 cents in coin to Firing Line, Post Office Box 5966, Columbia, South Carolina 29250. That's 25 cents to Firing Line, Post Office Box 5966, Columbia, South Carolina 29250. This program was made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is a presentation of the Southern Educational Communications Association.